Good evening, everyone. Good evening. You've tuned in to Paradigm Shifters. This is tonight's Paradigm Shifter is kind of playful for me because Todd Pitts has written a wonderful fictional account of, what would we say, life in the Mayan end times, but that's not how it starts and it's not how it ends. So let's talk to Todd Pitts about his exploration into the Mayan reality. Welcome to the show, Todd.
Thank you for having me, Veronica.
Oh, this is really fun for me. I just started reading this book a while ago, and I couldn't put it down. It was really very adventuresome and colorful, but you've got a lot of... I guess we should tell the listeners a tiny bit about it. Why don't you explain what the premise is of the book and how your friend William gets into it?
Okay. Well, basically, the story starts with this teenager, William. He's 17, going on 18, and he's down at a cenote in the Yucatan, and the story starts with him realizing that a woman he thinks has drowned, and he goes in to save her with his scuba gear. In the process, while he's down there, he doesn't find the body. He discovers her shirt, but he can't find her body anywhere. And then he sees this whirlpool kind of underwater that he gets caught up in. And he realizes that that's what kind of pulled her in as well. The whirlpool then sucks him into this underground caverns and rivers that go underneath the Yucatan there, which they're kind of famous for, and pours him into this other chamber where you can see that lots of people and bones are all over the place, and a lot of people have died there because they've been sucked in just the same way.
Hang on a sec, Todd. You use the word cenote.
Yeah.
Do you tell people what that means? I just looked it up again because I'd forgotten.
Okay. It's basically a limestone sinkhole that are common in the Yucatan. So it's, you know, pretty much a lake.
but it can pull you in, can it?
There are a lot of these cenotes have caverns that go, you know, deep inside underground and twist around. And some of these cave divers have gone into a lot of these different caverns and have explored them and penetrated very deeply into these caverns. So some of them go in quite far. And not saying that there is such a cavern that exists within this particular location, but I use this location as a starting point, a cenote called the Cenote Azul, which is in Bacalar near Chetumal, which is the capital city of the Yucatan Peninsula, or Yucatan State there.
And you're a diver, right? Have you gone diving in that area?
And so I've done a lot of diving, and most of my diving has been in, you know, the open water, but I've done a little bit of diving into cenotes and never really had the gumption to want to go out and do more of the penetrating dives that are really dangerous. But I did know a lot of divers that did do that. But anyhow,
tell me, so he goes into a time tunnel, right?
Right. So he discovers that there's all these bones around, but, you know, there's this cenote that he gets dumped into underground, and he realizes that perhaps the only way out of this, because nobody else has obviously found a way out, is that there must be a tunnel leading out of there. And so he decides, and he finds Betty, the a middle-aged woman who is the one that he believes had drowned before. He discovers that she's down there too, and she's okay. So they both go down together with his scuba gear and the remaining air that he has left in his tank and search around, and he discovers this strange passage that on the exterior of it there's a carving of a kind of a weird snake figure that that startles him at first, but then he realizes that it's just an entrance to a strange cavern where a red light is kind of flashing out of it. As he goes through it, he discovers sort of a portal that appears to be like a, what I would describe as just a roundish kind of, looks like a drainage pipe that just goes straight on with lights flashing all over. And as he goes shooting through it, the lights pick up in intensity and, until, you know, finally after several minutes, you know, all is calm again, and he realizes that he's outside of this, the underground cavern. And when they come back up, they're, you know, back outside in the jungle again. What they don't realize is that that passage, or what I call the serpent passage, and what the characters in the story have kind of, who they come across later, that they tell them that that's what it's called, this is the serpent passage. But anyhow, that they don't realize at that time that that passage just happened to have sent them 1,000 years back in time. So these two characters from our time, you know, get thrust back into the times of the ancient Maya, and they go through, you know, quite an adventure just to find their way back to some sort of civilization, which, you know, they think they're going back home, but they're following a trail, and they end up coming across, you know, basically a pyramids and whatnot that look like they're brand new and all painted. And so they begin to realize something is not quite right here. And the time is off with his watch. And so everything is a little bit out of kilter. And then they, you know, shortly thereafter, they run into conflicts with, you know, the inhabitants of this ancient city called Givenchy, which is an ancient Mayan civilization that's nearby that particular area. Mm. And that was a very strong kingdom in those times.
Does that city still exist?
Oh, no, it's all total ruins now. Mm. Like all the Mayan, ancient Mayan civilizations are all pretty much in ruins these days, but we've been able to, you know, through historians and archaeologists, piece together bits and pieces of their history from their glyphs and from, you know, the writing on their stone tablets, and in some cases on some of the bark paper that they would write on. So there's quite a bit of documentation that's beginning to grow just from those who were able to finally decipher the Mayan code and be able to understand how their writing worked. Hmm. and to be able to read it. So
so you did a lot of research too, didn't you?
Right. Well, so, and I guess, you know, that's pretty much the whole premise of the story is, you know, a couple people from our time who go back into the time of the ancient Maya who go through all these adventures, but the whole thing I was trying to convey was this interest that I have in the Mayan culture and in the ancient mythologies, and, you know, just all the incredible architecture that's down there. I wanted to find a way to pass on that interest to other people, but to do it in a fun and adventurous and exciting way, rather than just through textbooks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I thought it'd be fun to, you know, write a book like this that is more of what, it's kind of more like Lord of the Rings in the time of the ancient Maya. Mm-hmm. So something that would, you know, grab someone's interest and say, you know, hey, I want to learn more about that. And then on their own, they can do, you know, their own research and learn more history and dig into it deeper as they choose to.
You know, I think it's actually a wonderful way to present the history. And I don't want to tell people where the story goes quite. Because mm-hmm. being fiction, you want a whole bunch of excitement here as it builds up, don't you? You want some surprises.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you want to, you know, generate that interest and don't want to give away too many secrets. And I've had to do a few blogger interviews here and there along the way, too, and, you know, try to tell enough of the story to get people interested in reading it. But, you know, the real details of the story itself are fictional, and I take a lot of creative license with what I'm weaving together for the audience. And so...
So what about, you know, the description of the temples or the pyramids or some of those? Are they based on some of your research, or are you just very imaginative?
No, they really are. And in fact, you know, I lived down there for 2 years when I was becoming a scuba instructor. And I guess I should say what led to the inspiration of the story was I went down there on vacation for a couple weeks just to do some diving and happened to meet a lady at the same time. And we decided that, before I left that, her idea was, why don't you come down here and live with me and become a scuba instructor? And at the time I was a little burned out of my regular career and I thought that'd be a nice little sabbatical to take. And so I went ahead and just uprooted myself and moved down there, and that's what I did. I became a dive instructor.
Wonderful.
Just did a lot of diving in the Cancun area and Cozumel. Beautiful. So did most of my dives in my career were down in that area. I got to see, lots of wonderful things. And on the side, I would like to go and explore these ruins. And her dad, he lived out in the Chetumal area, and so there's a lot of these more ancient, remote ruins that aren't as popular as, say, Chichen Itza or Tulum or the ones that most of the tourists go to. And so you can go to some of these old ruins and find yourself the only visitors there that day, wandering around all by yourself, and you can almost sense the spirits are there around you somehow. It's just really a magical kind of a feeling. And I remember at one point I was in some ruin and walking through kind of an arched thing and had it in my mind, wouldn't it be so cool if I walked through this gateway and as soon as I passed through it, suddenly I was back in those days and I was back in the times of the ancient Maya when everything was at its peak splendor, and how incredible that must be to be in those times.
You channeled it, did you?
I sort of did, yeah. The idea was sort of just inspired in me that way, and along with my, general just intrigue of what I was seeing with all these, it just seems so amazing that a culture that was, existed thousands of years ago could have been so advanced, not only in their architecture, but in their understanding of time and space, to be that brilliant as they were back in those days when you think of them as, well, gosh, they must have been primitive Indians, but on the contrary, or they were, a lot of their science and astrology and astronomy was much more advanced than ours even, or at least equals ours today.
Well, what do you think of the Mayan calendar predictions that have been blown out of whack by Hollywood and so on? What do you think of all that?
Well, of course, that I think back in those days when I first was, this is back in 98, so I really didn't know too much about initially the end of the calendar and a lot of those things. I was initially more intrigued with the Mayan civilization in general. And then, of course, I quickly learned about that calendar and how they had the 2012 end date. And, and there are so many different theories and different
interpretations.
Mm-hmm. And some people see it as, it's, leading up to the end of the world. Other people see it as leading to a evolution of consciousness, which is what I would prefer to believe, that we're moving more toward a unity consciousness where, and you can kind of see it with all the technology we have when things, it has evolved to the point where we really are unity consciousness now. Mm-hmm. Things happen across the world and you instantly know about it on your cell phone.
Right. Isn't that amazing?
You just can't get away from information anymore. And so it's just all, so a lot of people believe that the calendar was tracking these different events in time, really from the start of the Big Bang forward.
I always think it's not so much the events, but it's more like these flows of consciousness that seem to move through the universe.
Well, exactly. Yeah, shifts in thinking and ideologies, and it's almost as if we pass through a time phase that allows us to suddenly have information about a new thing, kind of like it wasn't, you know, back in the 80s when suddenly, you know, people started to get into computers and look where we are now.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't too long ago that we had just barely invented the TV.
We've gone through a time tunnel too, haven't we?
Right.
Our relationship to time and space, I think.
Yeah, and there's a lot of, you know, good authors out there who have written, Carl Callahan for one, and Jose Arguelles is another who, you know, there's a lot of theorists who have, you know, come up with different thinking on the whole matter. I guess my whole point with my book was not to focus too much on the 2012 thing because it has been so, overly documented.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to instead, you know, go back in time to when, you know, the Mayans were at the point in the timeline of the Maya where my people arrive is what they call more of like the post-classic period. It's when most of the kingdoms in the southern lowlands have kind of been abandoned, and some of them have been abruptly abandoned, almost as if overnight.
Is it because of a lack of food all of a sudden, do you think? Or what do you think is the theory that matches your thought?
Well, you know, gosh, there are so many different theories, and I think only the people back there would know what really happened. But,
well, come on, Todd. We thought you were channeling them. Come on.
I do kind of cover a little bit of that at the end of my story, as you know. I have some other ideas as far as maybe extraterrestrial influence and things like that. But I think it's also very possible that they could have depleted their natural resources and had to move on.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, going along the idea of the shifts in timelines and in thinking, there comes a point where the Mayans, they stopped being able to believe in like a god king, that concept of a physical king who is also a god.
Mm-hmm.
They had a hard time, once that shift was made, they had a hard time following it. And it was about the same time that the Romans had a hard time following the ideology that the shift occurred almost at the same time when they stopped believing that, like, a Caesar could be an actual god or the Egyptian rulers could be gods, also incarnate. So there was a shift in thinking that so they could no longer follow this ideology, and it couldn't just be that a lot of, you know, these kingdoms, they just suddenly lost their power because nobody could follow that line of thinking anymore. And so my story kind of...
That's interesting. I've never thought of that parallel. That's very intriguing.
Right, yeah. It is very interesting how timelines are very much in sync across the globe as far as the way events have occurred and the way technology has evolved and things like that, and shifts in thinking about, you know, like even... giving rights to different, you know, to all people, and, you know, a lot of these different concepts were sort of universally more like downloaded upon us, is the way I think about it.
Yeah, or moving in waves through the collective, I think, too.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
right.
So are you a history nut, too, a history buff? Are you, who's Todd?
You know, I would say that history interests me, and particularly, you know, the history of the Mayans and other ancient cultures like that interests me a lot, just for the fact that they were so advanced back then, and then they suddenly collapsed, and then it makes me wonder, well, it's kind of a parallel to where we are now, and here we are so advanced, and where is that leading us? You know, are we going to end up like the Mayans and, you know, 1,000 years from now people will be digging through our ruins and trying to piece together remnants of our culture and wonder how it was that we were so advanced in our days. And I think the Mayan calendar, I believe, is, to me, it's more of a cycle. You know, they saw everything as cycles of every, you know, year, you know, they, every day, you know, there was, they had, you know, different glyphs for each day, and they had these different recurring cycles, and it could be at the end of the 2012 calendar, just a new cycle begins, mm-hmm. and it, you know, just starts over again. I don't know.
But it's already begun, I think. Also, I want to go back to the glyphs, because you've got a wonderful glyph at the beginning of each chapter. I thought that was brilliant. Smart.
Right. Well, those are actually basically just the numerology that they had. So each of those little glyphs at the start of the chapter correspond to like 1, 2, 3.
I thought they might have more meaning than that, Todd.
No. But there are plenty of cool glyphs in the Mayan calendar. And, you know, if you were to, you know, just do a little bit of research, you can find all sorts of things out there on glyphs that represent the different gods and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And so what I tried to do in this book is I tried to think about, well, what if, you know, these gods and these different demons and these creatures that they talk about in their legends, mm-hmm. weren't just, you know, imaginings. What if they were really things that were there in their time, that entities that they dealt with? And so that's what I tried to do, is give life to these different beings. The gods and the demons, I kind of viewed them more like on a spiritual plane, but that the Mayans would interact with them when they were like in a trance or in some kind of, you know, induced state where they could have contact with them or be manipulated by them in some form, and that these gods were somehow intertwined with the natural elements in different ways, so that they could shift things the way they wanted to create things, almost like these very high-level beings that are existing around us, kind of like spirits, you know, very high-energy spirits that are helping to transform the world the way they want to, some good and some bad. Mm-hmm. And so William encounters some of these entities along the way, as well as, you know, creatures that are typical of, for example, there's, you know, you've heard of the Chupacabra myths. Some call it the blood sucker that sucks the blood out of goats that farmers have reported, and it's been on lots of different documentaries here and there too. So that creature kind of is a very common creature in Mayan mythology. So I, you know, tapped that little idea and turned that into a real thing. The feathered serpents, you know, there's a feathered serpent god. The Mayans called him Kukulkan. There's also Quetzalcoatl, mm-hmm. you know, that the Aztecs referred to them as in the Toltecs. And so I thought, well, what if these feathered serpents were actually a race of beings that existed back then? And perhaps even today, maybe those are the same creatures that many of those who believe in extraterrestrials call the reptoid aliens of today, who very much resemble what the those back in those days called feathered serpents. And so I was doing a lot of, you know, playing with that kind of stuff, taking a lot of literary creativity there to just have fun with it and find ways to engage people's imagination and make them think, well, what if?
Yeah. Oh, no, it's really interesting. I'm curious as to, most of us think of the Mayans as having achieved kind of pinnacles of consciousness or high, superior spirituality, but the idea of having a lot of heads on spears in rows, it doesn't seem like that advanced, you know what I'm saying?
And all the sacrificing that they would do and things like that.
Yeah, a little bit of bloodletting for sure.
Right. And
mind you, we do that too at wars,
well,
don't we?
Yeah, sure. And exactly. You can very good comparisons. We think we're so evolved and advanced and spiritual, but look at the atrocities we've committed that are probably pale in comparison to what was done back in those days by, you know, and
well, they're not as obvious for the average person to see.
Exactly. It's a bit more behind the scenes, but pretty much any TV show any popular TV show these days usually has something to do about people getting killed or hurt, and that seems to be the common thread.
Yeah, and even though we don't behead and impale as much, we shoot a lot of people.
Right.
Which is, yeah.
There's just lots of TV programming on murdering and, you know.
Oh my gosh, yes.
It's just, you know, you don't find a lot of uplifting, spiritual type programming out there. It's true. And I think that they, you know, as far as I understand, they thought that blood was basically the essence of life and what connected us to the cosmos. Hmm. And their bloodletting, they would do bloodletting as well as sacrificing, but, you know, to, you know, just basically cut yourself and drain blood from your body as a way of offering that to the next dimension. Hmm. And of course that would, and some people make them so delirious that they would have visions and it would give them a connection to their ancestors, and they would have visions of, you know, seeing other things and other realms and
make answers to situations.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, it's similar to someone having a near-death experience, you know, or a traumatic experience like that. And I know that there was also a lot of use of probably psychedelic type of, you know, not drugs
herbs
back then, whatever herbs that they could find back then that would help them to connect to the to other dimensions that way. And
well, ayahuasca comes from down there, doesn't it?
What's that?
Ayahuasca comes from down there, doesn't it?
I believe so, yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of hallucinogenic type of plant life that's in that region.
So let's jump back. I don't want to get too far into the hallucinogenics right now. but let's go back to the bloodstone, which you introduced right at the near the very beginning of this story, right?
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that. Where did that idea come from? You're sure an imaginative fella, I'll tell you that.
Well, you know, it's funny because when I'm writing, sometimes I don't really know where my writing is taking me. I almost feel like the writing is channel it through me.
Oh, good.
And so I have a general idea of where I'm headed, but I don't know the details until I get there.
Hmm.
And so as I'm writing, like for example, at first I thought they were just giving him a necklace that was going to be just, you know, thanks for helping us out of the situation. They give William, they award him this necklace that he later comes to discover is called the Bloodstone, and it can only be worn, but it can only have one master, and once it's connected to that person, you are basically bonded to it.
Hmm.
And so them giving them and him accepting it, he didn't realize what he was doing. He thought he was just saying, oh, sure, glad to help, and he puts on this necklace. Well, so then later, as I'm writing the story, the stone itself takes on more life than I even realized was going to when I first introduced it.
Oh, that must have been fun for you. Like, wow, this is a living story through me.
Well, yeah. And then, you know, later to discover, not only does this bloodstone have powers that can connect William to the other realms so that he can basically go into the underworld and see the god of death, for example, or meet with the sun god, things like that. You know, or even have powers to, you know, suddenly create a fire or, you know, things like that. It gives him different powers that not normal people would have,
mm-hmm.
and only he can use it. And then later it occurred to me that, well, where did this bloodstone originate from? And then that's suddenly I had an inspiration of, well, maybe it's not, wasn't just a stone, but it was actually at one time somebody's heart, maybe the heart of a very powerful king, such as Pakal in Palenque, who many thought was a god, and at a time when gods could still incarnate into physical bodies. So anyhow, that's how I kind of played with that one.
I love it.
It does, you know, that's what's so fun about the writing process in general, is that you don't have to really know for sure all the details. You just have to have a general idea of where you're headed, mm-hmm. at least for me. And as I'm moving the story forward and new characters suddenly come in, and I don't know how important they're going to be until things sort of develop around them.
Hmm.
Some characters come and go, and other characters, you know, come and suddenly they become a fixture for a good part of the story. And so it's just really interesting to see how that develops.
Oh, that's so
neat.
It's
really a fun and creative process. And I do feel like, though, while I'm writing, I am somehow channeling these thoughts from another part outside of me.
That's great.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, this is wonderful. Well, so I noticed that your sequel, when I finished this book, I wrote to you and said, I want the sequel. And you said it's on its way, right? But I don't know much about it yet, but it's called The Bloodstone, right?
Right.
So,
and so it pretty much picks up where the other book left off. It doesn't really skip a beat. In fact, the first book has a sample chapter of the first chapter of the second book. So,
You
can kind of get, you know, a flavor of where you're headed in that, in the second book by just at the end of the first book. But the second book is pretty much all about, they realize that even though they've, in the first story, there's a curse gets put on the land that William needs to help resolve, and a curse on the bloodstone too. So they're able to, you know, work through some things to resolve that.
When they have a curse on the bloodstone, it means it can stop its powers?
Right, yeah, or it diverts it into more of a negative form than where it should be.
Hmm.
So they needed to remove this curse from the stone, and a curse on the land that was basically killing the land, so people couldn't even live there.
Hmm. So that was the description of the end of the Mayan culture.
Yeah, you know, things like that.
Well, I mean, if our beliefs
draw all kinds of parallels.
Sure, you can. So keep talking, because I'm interested in where how the bloodstone is going.
Mm-hmm. So at the start of the second book, William recognizes, because he's so bonded to the bloodstone, he can feel it almost like an appendage. You know, he can still sense that even though the curse has been lifted and the land has been healed, that its stones still feel weak. And it still doesn't feel right. Doesn't have the power it once had. And so they realize from the get-go that what they need to do is to revive the stone. And the only way to do that is in a ritual in Palenque, where the tomb of Pakal is.
Mm.
And so the whole story of the bloodstone is, while trying to escape these kind of nasty feathered serpents who are trying to capture them and kill them, they're also trying to make their way to Palenque to revive the bloodstone before it dies altogether. And so it's quite an adventurous story as it evolves, and you actually get to meet some of the feathered serpents, and some are good and some are bad. Other creatures are come into the picture as well. There's, for example, these bat creatures called Camazots that are common Mayan mythology characters too. And so pretty much any kind of a character that's in the Mayan mythology, I'll take a look at and decide whether or not it's something I might be able to use in some part of my stories. And, you know, so I get a lot of good ideas just from you know, doing a little bit of research on different aspects of the Mayan mythologies.
I like your use of symbolism. I'm just chuckling here because you're talking in some ways about the sort of the reptilian, the feathered serpent, an ET influence and so on. And I'm going, wow, it's a really wonderful time travel in every direction, or multidimensional travel, isn't it?
Well, yes. And, you know, of course, we've always had this in our culture, this obsession with extraterrestrials as well. And, you know, there's shows on the History Channel on ancient aliens, and whole series is on those, where, you know, so you don't have to look too far to find those parallels. So I play a lot on that, and even the creatures that we call, you know, the gray aliens are, they feature in my stories as well. So they're also components of their, of what's going on in these, in the stories, and they become prominent, you know, a prominent part of the evolution of the story as well. And so,
are you fascinated by aliens yourself, ETs? I mean,
you know, I really am, and I would like to think, you know, like probably a lot of people, that we're not alone in this huge universe, and that there must be other life forms out there besides us that are, you know, and also not just life forms, but higher evolved life forms that are benevolent and want to help us and that sort of thing. And I really like to think that. And I also think that there could be some, you know, creatures out there that maybe aren't so good. So
just a bigger version of where we're at right now. But I also think that we're going to be, okay, well, I guess one of the intriguing things about this book and about this conversation and this subject is that we are learning to move out of time as we know it in a way. I think that's part of our evolution, and I think that includes being able to relate to ETs, for example.
Right. I would agree with that. I think their, you know, perception of time, just like the Mayans, they had a different perception of time than we do today, that we're not, I mean, we're so driven by the, you know, every minute of every day. And to the Mayans, it was, you know, they viewed it more in a, you know, each day was its own little, separate universe, you know, and had its own special qualities. And they went on a cyclical calendar, and things would reoccur at the same time, around the same time of the year, and on the same days. And but of course, it's not lined up on a celestial calendar around the rotation of where planets align and things like that. It was more to do with a different spiritual calendar that they had.
Well, my understanding, because we've talked to C.J. Kalaman several times on this show, and my understanding of a lot of the things that I've heard about or read about is these flows of consciousness, they seem to be more attuned to the flows and the circuits of different influences as opposed to 24/7, that sort of thing, I think.
Exactly. We base so much of our thinking in terms of the clock and our the calendar that we use today, that I think there's a bigger calendar out there that is controlled by a higher power than us.
And also, do you think they were good at astrology as well as astronomy?
Well, they had their own astrology that I guess parallels a little bit some of the other, you know, Greek astrologies and things like that, but it is different. There are different books specifically on Mayan astrology. So, you know, they did have beliefs around alignments and, you know, when this alignment was in the sky, you know, this was going to happen. And, you know, so I think, you know, eclipses and things like that, they tracked very closely. And, you know, that's one thing I have to admit, that I'm not an expert in any of these areas. I'm very much probably a novice, as far as I wouldn't consider myself even an expert historian on Mayan culture. I know enough about the culture to be able to write about it in a fun and creative way, but again, I am focused on the fictional side of things. And just like I would with any story that I decide to write about, I would really research it well so that I could better come up with ideas and
visuals. You're good with the visuals.
Right. And mm-hmm. and so, I mean, if I was, you know, writing about some detective mystery, you know, I'd want to make sure I understood everything that went on in a police station, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So I try to gather enough information about the topic so that at least I understand it as fully as I can, and that can help me to generate ideas for different scenes and different scenarios, and to be able to, in words, explain clearly to the audience what things were like mm-hmm. in those times, and what tools they were using, what the people were wearing, how they looked, you know.
And what about what people are wearing? Were you able to track that historically? Or the other question I have is, when you're down there visiting ruins and things, were there museums with bits and pieces that you could see?
Well, there actually is a real famous museum in Chetumal where I can't remember the name of it, the Mayan Museum there, but it's got a lot of good history and a lot of ancient artifacts in there. So if you're ever in that, you know, region, I'd recommend popping into that museum to take a look at.
I'd love to go down there. What about the ruins? Were you able to, and are some of them under the water? Were you able to kind of get the feeling of the pyramids or the temples and so on?
Yeah, you know, when I first, for example, went to Chichen Itza, it was many years ago, and back then they used to let people go all the way up to the top of the pyramids, and, you know, you could go all the way to the top of the castle of Kukulcan, and, you know, it's a very steep incline and kind of spooky almost, walking, you get a little bit of, you know, the height going down, they had a rope there that people could hang on to, and you see a lot of people scooting down on their butt because it was so steep.
Wow.
But, you know, you could go in fact, inside of the castle of Kukulcan, it was built over the top of an older castle, and so there's actually a passage that you can go into, and I was able to go into that where you could go in between the two pyramids, really kind of a musty, dank corridor that leads you up to the top of the original pyramid that the other one sits on top of.
Wow.
And
I must give you a real sense of things, hey?
Yeah, if you're claustrophobic, you wouldn't want to do that. But, you know, these days, they don't really allow people to get very close to the ruins. Most everything, especially at Chichen Itza and some of the more well-known traveled ruins, probably I haven't seen Tulum recently, but they do chain off a lot of the areas around them, so you can't even go up them anymore.
You can sort of see why. I guess they can get really badly damaged. But they're made
right.
of rock, and are they made of rock?
They mostly
sandstone?
Use limestone,
okay.
Which was very easy
it's
access
soft.
For them back then, and it was, you know, easy an easier rock for them to cut than some of the harder rocks. They also used obsidian a lot for their sharper blades and that sort of thing. Obsidian is like volcanic glass, you know, chunks of volcanic rock that they would chip away and form into little sharp pieces that they would use on their weapons and their cutting tools. So, you know, they were very innovative. It's strange that, you know, as advanced as they were, they never used or came up with the idea of the wheel.
Hmm.
But they basically carried everything around on their backs.
Oh, wow, really?
Yeah.
How did they treat women?
You know, I don't know for certain. I think that they, you know, they were obviously goddesses, and, you know, and I believe that one of their calendars, their sacred calendar, is based on 260-day cycle, which is basically on the cycle of the woman's gestation period for, you know, giving birth. Hmm. And so I think they revered women, but I also think they felt that they had their place in the community. They wouldn't send women out to go hunting. You know, everyone seemed to have their role. Mm. But I think that from what I can tell anyhow, it seems as though they had respect for all, you know, all generations and all genders.
So even the old folks, huh?
But
it wasn't
more so even. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it wasn't matriarchal though, was it? No.
Not as much. No, it was more that everyone kind of knew their place and their role in life, and they were all kind of content with it. Mm. And from what I've seen, you know, going back and while I was down there, you know, of course things have advanced a little with modern teachings and things like that, and you know, the Catholic Church getting involved and stuff like that. They've changed a little bit over time, but you can still see some areas where there are some fairly indigenous cultures and around, and they still live in very rugged, rough conditions. And so one thing I've been doing that I wanted to mention is donating to charities that help impoverished Mayans today.
Yeah, I saw that on your website. I was going to ask you about that, so thanks. Yeah.
They are really, these poor people who were once so amazing and successful are now, you know, living in squalor. Hmm. And, you know, fortunately there are a lot of wonderful charities down there that do, you know, come in and help with not only providing, you know, food and education and things like that, but also with medical care, and so there is a lot of help out there, and I donate a percentage of the proceeds of my books to charities as well.
Oh, that's wonderful! And you get to find out where the money goes. Is it like a small group? Is it big or what? You know.
Well, the I used to go to a couple of them, and primarily I go to this one called MayaMission.com. Because they seem to work very directly within the communities, and over time I kind of liked, and I gathered a rapport with David Doss, who's the founder of it, and he's actually down there working with these people, and so I was just very impressed by the work they do. So I pretty much donate all my proceeds to help their cause at this time.
Oh, that's wonderful. So
but there are other groups that, you know, do things that, like, for example, like they're building machines that help to make soy milk.
Oh, really?
So there's different things you can contribute to that would help for more long-term sustaining efforts in other areas as well.
And you have a button to push for donate, right? Or do you?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. If you... Well, if you go to those links and then, you know, or look for any links on Mayan charities, those websites will have a donate button, and you can decide for yourself which ones appeal to you and feel like would be a good cause.
Okay.
To help these poor people who have, you know, given us so much in their history. So I felt like, gosh, it's something I want to give back to them. They've given me so much just in my growth of my spirituality, and because so much of the Mayan, philosophy is so spiritual based that it really helped me to grow as a person, learning more about them and their beliefs, and to have more compassion in my life in some way than I did before.
Wonderful.
And so I wanted to give back.
Can you I appreciate that. Can you recommend a source for Mayan spirituality that you really respect?
Well, I would say the one you mentioned before was Carl Kalaman. Mm-hmm. I think he is one that I've read almost all of his books. I know Barbara Handclough has written a lot of books as well on the topic, where they really basically get into the, you know, more spiritual side of what the Mayan calendar really means and what a lot of their underlying belief systems were.
Wonderful. And now, before we run out of time, and I appreciate that because I really respect both of those sources as well, I asked you earlier something that I forgot to track down, which is, are there ruins, Mayan ruins, under the water for you as a diver to experience?
You know, I don't think that, you know, all the Mayan ruins that I know of are on the Yucatan Peninsula there and in Guatemala and in the highlands. I don't believe there's been situations where, like an Atlantis type of scenario, where a big chunk of, you know, the peninsula has dropped below the waterline and has disappeared.
Okay.
So I'm not aware of any underwater Mayan ruins. Not to say that there couldn't be, but I'm just not aware of them.
I'm sure I could look that up, but I was just curious. The other thing is, we talked about the Bloodstone being the sequel to the Serpent Passage, but you've got fleshed out. You've got a third one, don't you?
Right. And at the end of the, again, at the end of the second book, I have the first chapter of the third book, so you kind of can get a taste of what the third book, where you're headed with that one. And now in the third book, see, in that time period where they're at, most of the Mayans started migrating more northerly, and that's when Chichen Itza became its peak time period, was when the other southern lowlands all faded away. Most of the activity had moved north to Chichen Itza, while there was also this Toltec influence coming in from the west, from the Toltecs, and that was, you know, prior to the Aztecs being around. And so that's why a lot of times you'll hear things like, oh, this is, you know, Maya-Toltec art or a Maya-Toltec pyramid, because they started to migrate their cultures together in such a way that they sort of became a singular migrated culture in time. So this story is kind of leading to the point where the Mayans and the Toltecs are kind of confronting, and at the same time they need to finish building this castle of Kukulkan that I mentioned, that is the one that's built over the top of the other one that I told you about. And this is a pyramid that many people know that on the equinox days, you can actually, if you are standing on a certain side, and when the sun is setting on an equinox, you can actually see the image of a slithering snake come down the steps.
Wow.
And so I thought, well, there's something, there must be some reason why they did that. You know, they aligned it just that way so that it would do that on the day of the equinox. And
they were pretty organized about that sort of thing. Hey, did you ever see that, Todd?
I haven't been able to see it in person. I've seen it on, you know, I think YouTube videos along the way. It happens twice a year every year or so.
Oh, wow, that's wonderful. So we're going to have to end, but what about, are you going to do a film script?
Right. I've actually already started a, I wasn't sure if I wanted to go with a movie or a TV series, and I started to think that a TV series might be a better way to go, just because there's so much there that I'd have to cut out to squeeze it into an hour and a half.
But I think there's another thing, which is it's flowing through you. It would be nice to keep it elongating instead of being truncated by one script.
Exactly, and plus my sister, she's been an actress her whole career, so she has some contacts in the TV industry that I'm hoping I can get in touch with. But I've already finished the pilot episode, which would be the very beginning of the first book, leading up to a kind of a pivotal moment at partway into chapter three, I think.
Oh, you've already shot some of it?
No, I've written the screenplay for it.
Oh,
and
wonderful.
So for the pilot itself, and, you know, of course, now is when I'm trying to, while I'm also working on writing the third book and promoting the second and first book, I'm also taking time to promote the screenplay and try to get some interest in having this possibly looked at as a TV series.
I think it's a brilliant idea, and of course, I'm in favor of that. So tell people how to get hold of you, Todd.
Well, I guess the easiest way would be to just go to serpentpassage.com, and that's where my website is and where you can find all the information, Facebook links and Twitter links and everything else like that. And there's, you know, news posted on events that are happening or, you know, anything going on with my, you know, book is posted there. So
wonderful.
Video trailers and stuff like that, you can access those there as well.
I found it a really wonderful, intriguing read. So,
right.
And that's a great place to start. I think you're pretty magical.
Or else toddallenpitts@gmail.com will work. I think that's also on my website, too. You can get to me either by toddallenpitts.com or serpentpassage.com.
Allen being A-L-L-E-N. There's so many different ways of spelling Allen, right?
That's true, too. I should probably point that out. So I figure it's always easier to direct them to serpentpassage.com because it's hard to misspell that one.
That's right. Well, this is Veronica Entwistle saying thank you so much to our guest, Todd Pitts, about his novel, The Serpent Passage, and the two sequels that are in the works as well, one being Bloodstone. I don't remember what the other one's called. Oh, The Castle of Kukulcan.
The Bloodstone is actually out, and it's available on Kindle and you know, paperback like the first one, and the third book is the last in the series, and we'll see if William can help them finish building that pyramid.
Wonderful. So I want to say to everyone, thank you so much for listening. Any feedback on this show, Veronica at veronicaentwistle.com, no H in Entwistle, or suggestions for other guests or feedback about Todd. Thank you so much for listening, and good night.